This is Sean Kennedy. I'm the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Nancy Berlinger. Nancy is a research scholar at the Hastings Center in Garrison, New York, and the author of an article in the October issue. And the article is called "Workarounds Are Routinely Used by Nurses, But Are They Ethical?" And I was very excited to get this piece because it brought back memories of all the workarounds from my clinical practice days. The most common one I think people can relate to is hiding linen so that you could have clean sheets for patients when you need them. We also hid certain types of medications so that we could have them when the pharmacy was closed, since the pharmacy wasn't open 24 hours. So there were many workarounds that I know we did and made our life easier. And when we posted a question on Facebook about do people do workarounds, we had 44 comments within the first day. And what amazed me was people were very proud of their workarounds. They wouldn't say what they were, but they were very proud and said, yep, I found a way to make my life easier and my patient care more efficient. But no one would kind of give up what they were. So, Nancy, what are the issues with workarounds? Because obviously they work if people keep doing them.
Well, I'm really happy to have an opportunity to talk about this topic further. This builds on a book that I wrote, which came out from Oxford University Press last year, and it's called Are Workarounds Ethical? And the reason I came up with that topic and this title in particular was I taught at the Yale School of Nursing. I taught MSN and DNP programs. And I began to think about this topic because I would hear nurses, when we were talking about issues like safety and quality and errors, begin to use workaround language, and they would describe something and call it a workaround, or they would say, well, you know what we do when we just get a stupid rule, we work around it, and it would be, as you say, a point of pride. So I began to listen to these examples and talk with the former dean of the Yale School of Nursing, the great Donna Deers, who's a great mentor in nursing in America, and she was interested in this as well, and she invited me to give a brown bag talk at Yale one day, and I made the topic, Are Workarounds Ethical? And I got three responses from faculty and from students. One was, how do you know about this? I'm not a nurse. I'm not a clinician. But I learned about it from eavesdropping, from hearing what nurses actually talked about. Two was, are you really going to talk about this? Because there was this sense, as you say, and as your Facebook entries suggest, that there was something secret about it, something that you weren't supposed to talk about, even though everybody knew about it. So that people found that intriguing. And the third was, and this was from a senior faculty member, you're not going to tell us they're unethical, right? Because we can't do our job without them. So that's how I knew I was onto a topic that had real ethical salience, as we say, in nursing. It really meant something to nurses to talk about this topic. And this wasn't necessarily a topic that other people might code as ethics, but it really was a right and wrong issue for nurses in nursing practice. So the way I think about workarounds is that these are situations where a clinician, in this case a nurse, but it could be a doctor, it could be many, many other professions, it could be an administrator, is forced to make a choice under pressure. They have to improvise. They have to come up with something. Often the expression is used, getting creative. The types of workaround behaviors that I've looked at, that people have told me about, that are present in the literature, there may be called a lot of different things. Some people might call these violations. Others people might talk about these as innovations. But they pretty much fall into four categories. One is getting the job done. You hear this all the time from nurses. The motive is efficiency. I can't get behind. I have to get things done. I have my way, nurses will say. I have my way of doing things. They might call it a shortcut or a fix. And they may involve rule breaking when policies don't match reality or when there's so many rules that you think, I can't follow all of these and get through the shift. So I'm going to have to pick and choose here based on my situational knowledge of what works and what doesn't work. So that's very common. People talk about that a lot. Another is this category that I mentioned of getting creative. There, the motive is not just efficiency, but problem solving and innovation. It might be called an invention. It might be called a fix, a hack, a patch. It may involve creating a non-standard way of doing something, fixing a device of some sort, so it's more comfortable maybe for a patient.
Mm-hmm.
It might involve adapting some rules, you know, making something work a little bit better. People might come up with an example that would say, well, this chair or this pillow was designed for an adult male, and I have a patient who's smaller or a pediatric patient. I had to change it a little bit to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this may also involve voiding a warranty, for example, or doing something a little unofficial here. So there are reasons why you would want to be explicit about mm-hmm. what you were doing. But it's a kind of a quality improvement activity,
mm-hmm.
Unofficially. Another type of workaround would be bending the rules. Here, the motive is fairness, the desire to be a decent person or a decent professional. It might be called tailoring the chart. It might be called working the system. It might be called being an advocate. It often involves a patient in front of you who needs a service, a medically appropriate service that you cannot deliver to that person for reasons that are not under your control. You can't rewrite rules. You can't rewrite law. You can't create resources where none exist. These often involve uninsured patients, psychiatric patients, undocumented patients. The reason they are ethically challenging situations is that when you divert resources toward one person, you're diverting them away from another person who may, in fact, be a better fit. So this could be a very subjective situation, like, I really want to go to bat for this kid, or I really want to go to bat for this mom. You know, I really feel that if I don't advocate for this person, no one else will. The system
mm-hmm.
doesn't care, whatever. But it can be very subjective, and it doesn't really fix the problem in the system. So those are why those cases can be difficult. And then there's the one that I call kicking the problem, which the motive is just avoiding the situation that's going to slow you down. It might be called turfing. It might be called delegation. It might be called churning. You might refer a patient somewhere else, or
mm-hmm.
you might just withdraw from the case. I'm just doing my job, but I don't want to get involved. And that's a real problem because the person who's sort of working around their psychological relationship with the patient, their need to be attentive to them, could be overlooking opportunities to improve this patient's care. I remember Donna Deers told me when she was collecting examples and just sort of, you know, looking around for interesting examples of workarounds, that she told me a young nurse, a newly qualified nurse, had said to her kind of proudly, "Oh, I have a new workaround." And Donna said, "Oh, really? Wow, because you've just started. What did you come up? What is this?" And she said, "Well, I just don't look my patients in the eyes."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and the student said, "Well, you know, because that really, no, she wasn't a student. She had graduated. She was an RN, and she said, because you know that could slow me down, and I find if I just you know do the tasks, you know, monitor vital signs or whatever it was that she needed to do, she could move more efficiently. So it was getting the job done, but you could see it was also a way of avoiding interaction with the patient."
Right.
And Donna, needless to say, found that very distressing.
Yeah.
That would be the lesson that the healthcare system would encourage a young clinician to learn, was non-engagement with patients.
Well, and it wasn't really the job, it was the task, and the job is really to give patient-centered care. So she wasn't really fulfilling the job per se, but just those tasks that you have to check off that are so valued by the system because they're on a check sheet.
Right. And, of course, that then one has to ask, what were the messages during onboarding, during orientation, from her supervisors that young nurse was getting about how to prioritize and what she needed to get done? So workarounds,
yeah,
as I said, are situations where you make choices under pressure. And so we want to ask, why do healthcare professionals, nurses and others, why do they devise workarounds? And I've listed some of the reasons why they
right.
do it. How should teaching and mentoring prepare workers for these problems with attention to their right and wrong dimensions. How do we talk about this in nursing education before people ever have a clinical experience? Like, this is one of the things that you are going to feel that you must do to be good at your job. And how should a healthcare system, via its leaders and its managers, analyze and respond to these problems which come from the system? If you look at literature from other complex systems, aviation and aeronautics and nuclear power stations, you'll see people talking about workarounds as well. It isn't just a healthcare issue.
Sure. Do you think, because there's such an emphasis now on quality and safety, and there's been certainly the initiative that's been around for a bit on quality and safety education in nursing, and we publish a lot on QI initiatives and improvements, that do you think that just that movement should help to bring the workarounds more to the fore? Because these are people who are finding better ways of doing something, and then they're testing them to see if they work and put it, and getting them hopefully into practice if they work. Do you think those types of movements and initiatives should address some of these, or will address some of these?
Well, I think that the move toward looking at quality improvement activities in healthcare as something that healthcare has to do, something as the what's called a learning healthcare system has to do,
right.
That it's not, you're not only doing research when you do that. You're trying to improve patient care in your own setting. That's something we need to take fully on board, and that's a good thing. However, we also know from years of study of checklist interventions, how people actually use checklists. In fact, I wrote an article about this recently, was that there are conditions where people feel pressure to set checklists aside, or if they get the message that the most senior person on a team doesn't value this, says, oh, let's just get this over with, you're going to start skipping steps under pressure. You're clearly getting the message that this isn't viewed as very important. And if we look at the original checklist research by Peter Pronovost and colleagues, which involved a nurse-led checklist procedure, which was very carefully structured as a support for behavior change in the relationship between doctors and nurses. It certainly wasn't just about rattling off a list.
Right.
The checklist was their kind of memorandum of how they had changed their behavior to keep a patient safe from infection. That's what works. That's what works, and it's not easy because it's so easy to just go to the idea of a simple list, but it's, patient safety is never simple.
Right.
So I think organizational leaders, chief nursing officers, chief medical officers, people in QI and quality improvement, have to say right out front regularly that organizational conditions create pressures on workers to improvise solutions that the system creates.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we want people to catch up. We want them to be, quote, heroes, pitch in, do more with less, you know, go lean, do all of these different things. And we don't want to know too much about how it happens. So we have to give workers, we have to signal that it's okay to talk about how we do our work. We should give workers opportunity to talk about these everyday problems. I'm always interested when somebody says this happens every day,
yeah.
Not this happened once in my career.
Mm-hmm.
Then you may need a special set of rules for it. But if it happens every day, it's a normal part of work.
Right.
But these can be hard to talk about if there's this secrecy attached to them.
And an everyday occurrence is signaling, I mean, that's really signaling that the system is really needs to be fixed in this area, as opposed to once in a while it comes up.
Right, right, exactly. It would be like if something happened, if your car broke down every day, you would need to do something about it. It would be really annoying,
yeah,
to have to pull over and do your little fix every day, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you would want to say, let's figure out what the problem is with the car. But I also think that we have to ourselves, if we use workarounds, and probably anyone who's ever touched a computer is familiar with a workaround, where somebody has said to you, oh, that, never mind what Microsoft says, do it this way.
Yeah.
You know, and there's zillions of patches and hacks for software that doesn't quite work. But I think we have to say to ourselves, you know, how do we balance out the pride that we might take in figuring out how to do our job well with our obligation to patient care. Mm-hmm. So this is a question I would pose to your readers and listeners is, when I devise a better way to get to my goal, whether it's a faster process or a more effective device, is it right or wrong to use it as a shortcut secretly? Can it just be my way? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it right to do that, or is it wrong to do that? Because when we ask about a right or wrong question, we're saying, what would be the consequences for a person other than me? I might have gotten through my day faster, but what if the next person who picks up my patients at the end of my shift during a handoff has no idea of what I've done because I've kept it secret, or they have a different way? Someone else may not be able to give an accounting of how patient care actually worked.
Right, and what actually worked for the patient, because nobody really knows what it was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Am I willing, let's say I say, you know, I have studied this situation, and there is really a better way. We could arrange these cabinets differently, or, you know, we could handle handoffs differently. There is a basic problem that we have here, and I've figured out a way to solve it. Am I willing to share this with others, beyond my maybe immediate friends? Or am I not? And if I'm not willing to, why am I not willing to? Do I really want just the patients I personally care for to have a better or safer experience, and I don't care about the others? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think most nurses would say that.
Right.
But we have to remember those could be the consequences of secret practices.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and I think if people listen to this conversation and hadn't read the article yet, I think there's plenty of to make them go read the article now. I think the article is really succinct and addresses a lot of these, but and we will do a blog post and put this out more on social media, so maybe we'll have to circle back with a part two on what people thought about workarounds. Well, what
that
people's
would be
response
a great
would
idea.
Be. Yeah. So, Nancy, thank you so much for your time and for this wonderful article, and more to come.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean.